Cha-ching. That's the sound of Lowe's Labor Day savings. Get up to 45% off select major appliances and save up to an additional $100 on select laundry pairs. Plus, get 3 bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil for just $10. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in-store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm visiting with Tyler Turman, writing for Civitas Outlook at Civitas Institute about the Haussmannization of Paris, the city we've all visited, assuming that everybody knew that this is a gem that didn't exist before the late 19th century. And it existed because of the will of a dictator, Napoleon III, who eventually would make some bad choices and be driven from the battlefield. But while he was powerful, he hired a man named Baron Haussmann to make the city livable, because it wasn't. The medieval city was unacceptable. It was, it drove you away. Let's put it that way. You were not going to shop there. You certainly didn't want to walk through the streets at night. However, Haussmann had 60,000 workers. I'm following Tyler's reporting. And he demolished 20,000 buildings. Buildings? What buildings? Where did he actually level the city? Is that what he did, Tyler?
Yes, he demolished upwards of 60% of medieval Paris's old buildings. And most of these buildings were in working class neighborhoods, especially in the city center. He once cruelly remarked that it's easier to cut through the pie at the center than at the crust. And so he wanted to, I suppose, economically segregate the city to where the city center was the cultural and economic hub for the wealthy. And then after annexing many of the city's suburbs, he would then move the working class over to the city's outskirts. And so, yes, he very much did demolish much of the old Paris. In fact, is what made him very unpopular. He was famously called the demolitioner or the artistic demolitioner by many of Paris's working class. And of course, many of the working class residents lamented the old Paris of Voltaire at the time, where they were sort of getting nostalgic for the Paris before the time of Haussmannization. But in many ways, Haussmannization was what revitalized Paris. And you also mentioned how it was a very dark and unsafe city to live in. And so one of the major projects that Napoleon commissioned Haussmann to do was to build 15,000 new gas lamps all across the city to make it a more livable city, also more light. But of course, it could also deter crime because criminals obviously will not be doing their crimes in the broadness of, I suppose, more light, so to speak, in sort of the dark alleyways that Paris once thrived in at the time before Haussmannization. So Haussmann, in many ways, wanted Paris to emulate other cities like London, Vienna, and Rome. And so that was sort of his goal, was he economically segregated the city in many different ways that is sort of contingent and still seen in Paris still today, even 154 years later.
Where did he get the money? Where did Napoleon III? How did he do it?
So Napoleon III, of course, benefited from being an autocrat, being the emperor. So he didn't have to accede to checks and balances and democratic processes like the way he did before when he was president from 1848 to 1851, when he wasn't eligible to be reelected. But he benefited from, of course, new expropriation laws after abolishing the National Assembly in 1852. And Haussmann, of course, was given incredible leeway in terms of what he could do. And so Haussmann would frequently use eminent domain to seize private property and then use it for redevelopment to sell to financiers. But what made Paris really special and, I suppose, different from previous urban projects at the time was it was very much a private and public cooperation here, where they would get the funds from taxpayers, of course, but in many ways, private financiers and entrepreneurs and, I suppose, real estate brokers and people who were in charge of major private parts of the city funded these projects by loaning the money out to banks, and the banks would then finance these projects as well. And so it was very interesting because it was both a private and public enterprise. But of course, it was all done under the oversight of, as you mentioned before, a dictator with Napoleon III and his right-hand man with Haussmann.
Haussmann had rules about buildings, how big, how wide, how did he do it? Is that why Paris strikes us as short, because of Haussmann?
I would say yes. In many ways, Haussmann blocks, as they're known today, are still prevalent in Paris across the city today. When you look to the city center and the different roads that are sort of coming from the Arc de Triomphe, you will see a sort of architectural uniformity here. Like I mentioned before, Haussmann saw buildings as sort of part of a greater whole. And so he wanted a city that was both uniform and coordinated, but also very I suppose, linear in terms of its architectural structure. So he followed a very strict building code, which if you go to Paris today, you can still see it followed. It's five-story buildings, it's balconies on every other floor, it's very 45-degree angular type of building structures, but it's also a very specific type of roof structure as well. And so Haussmann blocks in many ways comprise of the vast majority of Paris's housing units today.
And what we're looking at here also is objection, because there were political decisions being made. You mentioned one about wide boulevards. Why?
So wide boulevards were presented to the public as a sort of public health problem, because naturally the narrow streets, one, made it a lot difficult for air to circulate. It was difficult for light to get through. And so the wider blocks were seen as a public health response to this, where you'd get more air circulation, you'd get more sunlight. You could also make transportation easier. So it would in many ways revitalize Paris's infrastructure to make it more easier to move supplies and wagons throughout the city. And so those are sort of the public justifications behind the widening of boulevards. But as Napoleon and Haussmann themselves would actually admit in private, the widening of boulevards actually served as a mechanism for, one, making it a lot more difficult to build barricades, which were, of course, a stapling point for the 1830-1848 revolutions. So Napoleon, being emperor, perhaps recognized that he would still get a lot of dissent from Republicans who were still more sympathetic to the French Republic. And so he wanted to deter the ability for the working class Parisians to be able to rebel against him. And of course, the widening of boulevards made it more difficult to build barricades, but it also made it more easy for him to be able to transport troops across the city into the city's outskirts and suburbs where the working class typically tended to live after they were displaced. And so it doubled as a example of social and political engineering to make it more easy to justify troop movements, but also make it more easier to dismantle barricades. But it doubled as a public health problem that was being resolved by widening the boulevards. But as we mentioned before, there are always going to be ulterior motives that are less than benevolent and altruistic than they're typically promulgated as by their planners.
We're headed to the crash, but just a moment. There are photographs of the old city. Where are they? Charles Marville.
Yes. So Charles Marville was actually a critical component in Napoleon's propaganda campaign, because naturally, when you're turning a city into a 17-year-long public works project, people are going to be very unhappy with the construction constantly being across the city. And so Marville was basically a key political tool for Napoleon, where he wanted to show before and after pictures of the city. So he would take pictures of old, dilapidated neighborhoods, and then he would say, see, this is what the neighborhood looked like before. And then after urban renewal projects were done, he would take pictures of the neighborhoods after, and he could show to the public, this is what we're doing, this is the good work that we're doing. And so you can look up Charles Marville on Google and you can find his pictures. They're actually quite famous. There are many different neighborhoods that he has. One of them, for example, is the Ile de la Cité and Quartier de l'Arcis, or Arcis. I'm probably butchering the names because I'm not French, but you can find them on Google online, and they're actually rather striking in terms of just how wide the scope was. You can see pictures of entire neighborhoods being demolished and bulldozed and completely flattened, and you can see construction workers working on the new projects, but you can also see people who had lost their homes standing in front of areas where their neighborhood once was, and it's very sobering to see the consequences, unintended or otherwise, of these urban renewal projects that we can see in Paris, but also across the world today.
150 years later, the project crashes into the War of 1870, which drove Napoleon III from the field and rendered Paris under siege by the Prussians that was shelled. However, these many years later, what is the memory in France of Haussmann and Napoleon III? Are they considered successful for what they did, or were they brutes who wrecked the romance of the city? How is the literature today, Tyler? We have about a minute.
Yes. So in many ways, Haussmann is seen as a rather divisive figure in Paris, and it sort of depends on who you ask. There are many people who are in Paris who recognize Haussmann and laud him for his efforts in Paris in revitalizing the city. But as time goes on, people start to see Haussmann as more of a figure who in many ways bulldozed the ancient city, and people at the time were very critical of him. But it sort of depends on what you prioritize. If you look at Paris as the way it is today, you can see, oh, this is net positive. But of course, if you look at the underlying negative consequences of urban renewal, you can see that it was actually a lot more mixed. And so it's open to our interpretation whether or not you consider Paris to be a success story, but it does go to show that there are always going to be consequences and negative externalities of urban policies, and it's important for people to recognize that whenever they pass policy.
Are they still arguing about it, Tyler? Did you find controversy over Haussmann?
In some respects, yes, because Paris is still undergoing a sort of renovation. And as different cities across the country and across the world today even grapple with new effects and new problems with climate change, income inequality, and the consequences of longstanding gentrification, and urban renewal projects and urban planners are still looking to solve these issues, they very frequently look to Paris as the example. But of course, as time goes on, we begin to see the negative consequences of it that people don't necessarily recognize, but they're becoming well known today. So Paris is still a hotbed of contention in both Parisians and Frenchmen, but also people across the world who look to France as a model for urban renewal.
Tyler Turman for Civitas Outlook at Civitas Institute, the University of Texas at Austin. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.